Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. This episode is brought to you by me. That said, huge shout out to the sponsors thus far, Stream by AlphaSense and Coifin. You can find them at streamrg.com. That's streamrg.com. And Coifin.com, Koyfin.com. Really appreciate their early support of the show. Following this episode, we'll be on break for a month or two. The first break benefited the show. I'm pretty certain this one will as well. To the fans, thank you for listening. I'll come back with a product that continues to improve and is worthy of your time. This episode features Dave Girard. Dave is one of the founders of Upstart. If you don't know, Upstart is looking to disrupt credit underwriting using artificial intelligence and machine learning. They look at variables outside of the traditional underwriting metrics, such as FICO score. They're leaning on things like, where did people go to college? Where are they hired? What's the trajectory of their income? A bunch of different factors. At least that's my perception of what they do. I used to be skeptical of artificial intelligence and machine learning claims. I used to think it was marketing speak to pump stock prices. Now I'm much more hopeful that the claims are true, and I lean towards believing that they are. I hope that you enjoy this conversation. I greatly enjoyed speaking with Dave, and I'm grateful he said yes to coming on the show. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. So with that out of the way, thanks again for another season. And we'll be back. Thrilled to be joined by Dave Girard today. Dave, we met because you listened to the episode with David Gardner and commented on it.
Yeah, I thought it was a great episode. I hadn't heard either of you before, so I happened to just hear an episode where you interviewed David, and I thought it was fantastic. And anyway, it was definitely inspiration for me to reach out to you.
He's got an infectious personality.
Yeah.
Like, he's so positive.
Yeah. I amazingly, I haven't had a lot of interaction with Motley Fool for their long history, for whatever reason, until they started to have things they were writing about Upstart, of course, started to pay a little more attention to it. But that he and his, his brother, pretty amazing guys.
Yeah. I believe it was on Patrick O'Shaughnessy's podcast, but maybe not. You had mentioned that in public markets, the shareholders can choose to be your partner whenever they want, and they can come and go. I think that the foolish investors that listen to this are not those type of people. They are the buy and hold types. So that's something that I really respect about how David and Tom have taught the art of investing. Still trying to learn it myself.
Yeah, hard to do. It's a very emotional game, but those guys clearly have figured something out and made a great business from it.
Yeah. So do you want to give people a brief background of, you know, where you came from and then the Upstart story and how it got started? You know, we don't need to go through everything, but sure. I do think, you know, hitting on you were at Google and then how you came up with the idea. And I don't know if you still own liquidgrad.com, but mention that.
Yeah. So, you know, very briefly, I mean, I'm an East Coast native. I grew up outside Boston, but came out to California in the, 1993, pre-Netscape, as I like to say. So, and, I got into the technology world really first with Apple in really a long time ago, frankly, before Steve Jobs even came back to the company, if you want to talk about long time ago. Found my way to another startup for a bunch of years. And then I did end up at Google starting in 2004. So quite a while ago now. And any case, I for 8 years was at Google. I built what's now their cloud business. And without belaboring that, I built it into a fairly large business, but under the domain of a mega giant business. So it was always kind of what I would call other. When we would be reviewed at Google, the cloud app business, what we called Google Apps, was always in that other category. Some sense it still is. Even cloud is still modest compared to the crazy ad business. But in any case, about a decade ago, I'd been there 8 years. it was great, amazing experience, but you know, kind of got that itch. I was in my mid 40s at the time and said, hey, you know, I've never actually started a company. So I definitely had this thing in my head where I was suddenly open to the idea of, you know, hey, maybe I can start a company. Maybe I didn't need to be Google. I could actually do something outside of Google. And, you know, so I had a bunch of sort of period of time where I was just thinking through ideas and got very interested in access to credit or access to capital and how the system worked for really just honestly conversations I happen to have with some people that just struck me as it was a really broken system, one that was really limited, hadn't really been affected in any way by the internet, meaning like it existed as it did, you know, in 2011, when I was thinking about this, it pretty much looked like it did in, you know, 1992. So just felt like an opportunity and decided 8 years into Google, I was going to leave and found this company. And my wife was supportive. You know, we'd done pretty well at Google, so we weren't sort of like putting our lifestyle at risk, if you will. I didn't, you know, made enough money. So I wasn't that kind of bet where I was kind of betting the farm, if you will. So made the leap after thinking about it for a few months, talking to a bunch of people about whether they might join me. Most of them said no. And then, you know, fortunately found a couple of founders right at the time I was really pulling the ripcord and leaving. And that's how Upstart came to be. It was, you know, beginning of 2012 now.
When you talk about your upbringing, you mentioned that your family, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't know that struggled is exactly the right word, but worked really hard and didn't have a ton. Did you perceive like your parents to be credit restricted? Like, is that like some of what the seed germinated, or was it mostly? I've also heard you talk about when you were looking at hiring grads at Google and you were like, this is absurd. These people are coming from great schools and they can't get credit. Like, this doesn't make sense. I just didn't know if it was like deep in you that you'd been working on for a while or not.
Well, you know, I grew up in a family that never had any net worth at all. My parents were both like the first in their families to go to college. They grew up in North Cambridge and in Somerville respectively. And then, you know, they moved to the suburb and bought a house, which to them was like the greatest thing in the world. So they were that generation of like, you know, get a job, buy a home in the suburbs. Wow. It's amazing. Have a flock of kids. So you know, we had a little house, a lot of kids and we never felt poor. Trust me. My parents probably always felt like, wow, we're so fortunate to be where we are living in this beautiful suburb of Boston, et cetera. So that's just what I grew up in. There was no entrepreneur or anything, but you know, when I think about my history beyond that, you know, I went to Dartmouth College. I went to grad school, University of Michigan. I moved to California, you know, bought my first car, bought my first house. And when I think about my own trajectory, it really was actually access to credit that unlocked all these things. You know, we just never had money to pay for anything. So it was all done on credit. And so I'm kind of a product of the system when it works well. And it just sort of later, you know, began to drive the thought of like, well, what would have happened if I couldn't have gotten this loan or that loan, or if I was still paying too much for X, Y, or Z? And, you know, so it really struck me that in some sense, the price of credit is the price of mobility or opportunity. And there's an opportunity to really overhaul that and make it work much, much better for many, many more people. So I would say, if anything, that was sort of the genesis of it. It's a little bit of the history of my own person. And again, I never remotely felt I was growing up poor. It was just life. We were perfectly fine. We were never hungry or anything like that. But clearly getting on the trajectory I got on, it was certainly unlocked by access to credit, which is just part of the American system, I think.
Yeah. My takeaway from studying Upstart is what you're talking about. The fact that you're saying, I you know, you've repeated now a couple of times, I never, like, I didn't grow up poor. The point that I think that I have adopted from reading you and listening to you is that there's so many underbanked out there that it's not justifiable why they're underbanked. They are on a trajectory towards prime, and traditional FICO scores simply forget about them or don't even rank them, and they're left out of the access to credit. And it seems to me that was one of the problems that you were looking to solve. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I mean, I think as the idea got, you know, sort of peeled apart and thought about a lot more, became obvious that the credit system, you know, works really well for a thin slice of America, you know. And in some sense, credit scores themselves are kind of inherited. You know, one of the things everybody tends to do is, you know, you get a credit card for your teenager and your teenager suddenly starts to build their credit really based on yours, which is a form of inheritance. And that's all well and good. Nobody should be blamed for that. But there's a whole set of people who are left out of that. They don't, their parents don't have, you know, good credit, and they certainly don't have the ability to bequeath that on their kids. So in some sense, you're outside the system, you're locked outside of it, and everything just gets much harder. It's not to say you can't possibly break your way in and do the right things, but it's just really hard. And so our sort of notion became, you know, there's this like perimeter, and the fortunate people live inside this perimeter where banks work with them, offer them services, offer them credit cards, might give them a mortgage. And then there's this whole part of the population, which is frankly tens of millions of people who live outside the perimeter. Banks just don't serve them. And, you know, our view generally is we can move that perimeter dramatically. We can't solve all of it. I mean, there's some more, you know, structural inequities and problems that, you know, we can't solve all of it, but we can play a big role in helping to identify more people that should be worthy of credit, reducing the price of borrowing. And, you know, it's just sort of like many of those people who at a moment in time, they're either going to head down this bad path in life that's going to be very difficult financially as long as they'll live, or maybe they'll just get on the other side of it and they'll suddenly live in a world where, you know, they don't worry about money every minute, every day. And we really feel like we can affect that fork in the road for a lot of people and get them into a better state.
Yeah, one thing that I enjoy listening to you speak about is the idea of driving down the aggregate cost of credit, right? If you can bring a more accurate pricing decision, there are people that would be quoted, you know, I don't know exactly what it is and what you can save, but long story short, I believe I was listening to a speech, like I think you gave it like 4 years ago, and I think you said FICO scores capture like 43% or something like that of a borrower's probable behavior. And your models at that point that you'd cited had gotten to north of 80%. So that's a significant delta.
What that really was, you know, there's many ways to kind of show the world that there's this enormous inefficiency in the system. And you could illustrate it many different ways. But one of the most stark ways we found that people can just grasp quickly is in the numbers. The numbers do change a little bit, so I don't know the exact number as this moment, but something like 80 to 83% of Americans who have gotten some kind of loan or credit have never defaulted on it. Okay. But less than half of Americans, maybe it's 48%, actually have a credit score good enough that a bank would give them a loan. So you just have this enormous gulf between 48 and 83, or, you know, whatever those exact numbers are, that just says, like, where are those people? What is going on here? And it just is, it's kind of a very simplistic way to highlight the enormous inefficiency in the system and how much it's underserving many millions of Americans.
One thing that as I've studied your business, I'm curious, not just within Upstart, but within the economy. And I think you have a really good idea of the answer to this question. Machine learning, like, how much is this going to change in our lives? And, like, how much is the edge that data provides in reality to, like, that? It's something that not dealing in the field, I don't have it. I just read about it and it's like, well, data is the new oil and machine learning is great. But it's hard for me to conceptualize. So I was curious to hear you talk about it a little, if you're willing.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I would say sometimes referred to as AI, sometimes as machine learning, and there's in some sense they can be interchangeable. But the domain really, in some sense, is the next level of computation and what's possible to do with computers that humans either couldn't do really well or limited in some fashion. And so, you know, it's built on some building blocks of things that have come to maturity itself. The algorithms that are famous and known and shared in AI, you know, that sort of cutting edge of technology has really been on in the works for a few decades. I mean, honestly, the notion of machine learning and but the idea generally is, you know, it's software that learns on its own, meaning as it experiences the world, as it interacts with the world, it actually gets better. It's better at predicting what will happen next. And that's the heart of machine learning is, you know, the prior world would be this, the software engineer needs to tell the thing exactly what to do. If this, then that. And through an enormous complexity in a set of rules defined in software That's what the software does. And almost our entire history of knowing what software is in the business world or consumer world anywhere is exactly that. But suddenly you have this software where the programmer is not telling it exactly what to do. And it's actually learning from experience. And that's why it's kind of notionally described as artificial intelligence, is it's learning the way humans learn, which is through interaction with the real world. That's how a baby learns to talk and to do everything else and walk. So that notion is interesting because, you know, computers, theoretically, the microprocessors get faster, storage gets cheaper. Cloud computing has really just sort of made enormous amounts of computation available at radically lower cost than it would have been 20 years ago. And you put that all together and suddenly it's possible to do things in software or in computers generally that would have been unheard of, you know, a while back. And what we're doing is just one particular domain of it, the domain of credit and lending. And it happens to be a good fit because there's a huge amount of risk and unknowns. You can think about it as every time as a bank or a credit union or some type of lender that you make a loan, you're making a prediction about the future. You're expressing your opinion about the likelihood that this money's going to come back to me and when, et cetera. And it just shouldn't be at all surprising that like computers can do that better than people. And now with AI and modern, you know, cloud computing, et cetera, the difference is increasingly dramatic, how much better a computer can be than a person at making a loan. And that's the heart of it. There's so many other domains. You can think of medical science and autonomous vehicles and language, learning languages or translating languages. There's just so many domains that AI can have enormous impact over time on. And it's really, I think it was really gated by cloud computing, meaning some of these ideas have been around a long time, but you needed so much power of computation. It was just so expensive that it didn't really come into the mainstream until cloud computing began to sort of unlock the availability of that much compute.
So when you were building out what's now known as Google Cloud, was that like, at what point did maybe you realize that, I guess, did you go into building that out thinking like, boy, we can build out a tool set that smaller businesses can use and look at what it can do for everybody? Or were you more like building it for internal use and then figured out how to generate revenue out of a cost center?
Well, I'll say, first of all,
does that make sense? Is it even the right question?
It's a great question. I left Google 10 years ago. So if you listen to Google today, Sundar, who was my last boss at Google, he's the CEO of Google, he will talk about AI every time he can. It's clearly very central to how Google sees, or Alphabet, I guess as they're called, sees the future and their play in the world, if you will. If you went back 10 years when I left, you know, my whole time there was just focused on what I would just call a prerequisite to that, which was just cloud computing itself. And the idea that Google could, in various ways, deliver value to a company or to a consumer through this massive computational capability it had. Most of my time there was really focused on just the applications. If you use Gmail or if you use Google Docs or Google Calendar and you're a business or a school, et cetera, that was largely the focus in the time I was there. Now it's become much more general purpose, this sort of compute and sort of competition with Amazon. But as I said, I think of that as a prerequisite to AI. And it's a no-brainer now. When we started pitching to people in, let's just say, 2006, 2007, hey, you can get rid of your email servers, you can shut down your Exchange servers and just use Gmail in the cloud, it was like, are you out of your freaking mind? That we would never do that. And I remember this woman who was a CIO at a large university, and we had already had maybe 10 universities that had signed up to use Gmail for all their students, which, by the way, every school in the country does now. And I don't remember what school she was from. Might have been, I won't even say, I don't want to implicate her, but she kind of said to us, you know, I just want to tell you, all these CIOs that you've convinced to move their students to Gmail, they're all going to get fired. And I was like, that would be really bad. Anyway, a few years later, literally,
I thought I was doing a good thing.
Yeah, I thought this was good. And literally a few years later, virtually every university in the country had moved to Gmail with their own private, you know, sort of look and feel, et cetera. But so this is the kind of fun of this stuff, is it's cutting edge stuff. It's scary to people. And it's a long journey to get the world to accept it. And it's exactly what we're doing today, different type of problem into a different industry, but it has the same, you know, the same challenges.
So I think the your experience in building cloud is interesting to me, because when you left, here we are 10 years later, you know, and it's easy to say, oh, well, of course Upstart worked, right? Like that's it was inevitable. They're public and they're winning, and sure. But when do you think that some of the ethos at Google and the willingness to sort of like lay the groundwork and wait, do you think that that's what helped you maybe start Upstart in the way that you did? Because as I understand it, it was quite a push uphill. I mean, you had to get banks on board. You had to get the algorithms to learn. Like, that's a lot of patience that maybe today, looking back, we don't appreciate.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, first of all, truth be told, we barely made it. There are several times where our ongoing existence was highly in doubt, to be frank. The first version of Upstart, you know, frankly, didn't really work. We went through a significant pivot a year or so into the company's existence. Suddenly got to something that worked better, but we either felt like late to a market that was already had taken off, or then the market itself, meaning kind of online lending, crashed in 2016. And suddenly we were doing okay, but it was a market that went out of favor. So
you're talking about the lending, not LendingTree. What was it?
Yeah, LendingClub had some issues back then, right. and it just sort of reset the whole industry. And suddenly we were doing well, but the industry was so out of favor that it didn't even matter. People were like, oh, that thing. Oh, God, that. So, you know, we had no shortage of challenges. I would just say the thing that made it work for us is we had a team that really worked well together. We never felt like we were down to our last dollar or were ready to quit. None of us remotely felt like we were ready to throw in the towel. None of us wanted to go get a job or, you know, go back to Google or anything like that. So there was just a conviction that the long-term view of what we wanted to do was sound, that we had a great team and we could navigate all these terrible things that were happening, you know, investors not wanting to give us money or the market turning upside down or whatever it would be. There was just lots of them. But, you know, that's the startup story. You just have to stick with it. Not all will work out, but in our case, we always just had conviction that we have a great team and we're going to get to the right answer. And hopefully we'll get to the right answer quickly enough and repeat the process enough that we'll build something sustainable. But probably it wasn't until, you know, quite a few years later, 2017, 2018, that suddenly we really had our feet and we felt confident.
Huh. So it was that long before you really felt like you had traction and that you, so, okay, let's rewind real quick. Something that you've said, it was great to get your ex-employer as a seed investor, but then when they didn't re-up in the A round, it created a bit of a problem perceptually.
Yeah.
So as you're struggling and the business is pivoting and you're just trying to get one person to give you a check, like how do you get the grit to stay with it? I know that that's maybe a hard question to answer, but is it innate? Is it something that the team had together? Like, that takes a lot of character to keep pushing.
That was the hardest part for the company. We hadn't actually yet pivoted, but we needed to raise our Series A after having done a Series Seed, which was trivially easy when I was leaving Google. And essentially, we made what I would call a rookie founder mistake, which is we took seed money from three institutional investors, including my prior employer. And when we needed to raise our A round, in short, all three of them said, we'll wait a while and see how you guys do. But we needed to raise money. So suddenly you're out raising money and everybody's going, well, what about them, and them? Why aren't they going to lead this round? Well, you know, that's a signaling problem. And I was warned about it and said, oh, we won't have that problem. And we had that problem. But in any case, you know, it did take, we probably got 30, 40 no's in that round itself. For that reason, essentially, like, there must be something wrong. And then, frankly, one of our early investors, who was a much smaller one, First Round Capital, is the one that stepped up and said, screw it, we think this company's going to work and we'll lead this round. They didn't lead as big of a round because they're a seed fund. They don't generally lead later rounds. And it was a smaller amount of money, but it got us to the next step. And that's effectively what we needed, which is why, you know, we will always tip my hat to First Round Capital as the company that stuck with us and frankly saved us. We wouldn't be here today. And they've been, you know, great partners all through the journey.
That's awesome. Good for them. Good outcome for everybody, right? That's how it's supposed to work.
That's right.
So how many, I mean, at that point you had young children, right? But I guess it's not, you said your lifestyle wasn't at risk, but I would think like there's something, I ran a small flooring company, nothing like Upstart, but man, it sucked. Like I was working so hard and it's like the sales just weren't coming. It was 2009 and I'm out there and I'm like busting my ass and nothing was working. And I remember sleeping on the office floor and just being like, why can't I push this rock uphill? It's very, very cool that you pivoted and cracked the nut, so to speak, and that was, you know, the beginning of Exit Velocity, which occurred, what, 6 years after that or something, right?
Yeah, not that many, but it took a while. The first pivot was definitely the glove save for the company, if you will, but we had plenty of, just to mix analogies, turbulence after that, yeah, before we really were on solid footing.
So what was the pivot, just so that people understand exactly how you were thinking and what you saw and how you saved it?
Yeah, the original notion for Upstart was something that became known as an income share agreement. So the idea generally was, instead of getting a loan at a particular interest rate, you would actually get some money, but you would pay it back as a fraction of what you earn over a period of years. Hmm. So something sort of almost out of the like University of Chicago School of Economics. So it has a lot of history to it, but we were the first really to try to create a company and a marketplace around sharing your income. And man, we got so much press because it was the craziest idea. People would just, New York Times, I mean, everybody would cover us and be like, oh my God, is this indentured servitude or is it ultimate freedom or what is this thing? And we didn't really know we were stepping into this thing with all kinds of like political overtones, and it's a libertarian's dream. But of course, you know, so, and it was interesting. We had our zealots. We suddenly got a couple hundred people who sold pieces of their income. We had investors who put the money in. It was like Kickstarter, but you were like buying a fraction of someone's future income. But ultimately it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't going to scale. You kind of think, oh, well, we thought we would have 1,000 people funded by now. And it turns out we have like 45. What's going on? So you kind of, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you keep kind of dialing the knobs and trying to figure out if you can make it work. And we did that for quite a few months. And I always like to say, I mean, people don't know, like there's this metaphor of when is it time to quit? Well, quitting never sounds like a good thing, but of course there's times to pivot and realize that what you're doing isn't going to work and move to something else. And, you know, ultimately there was a time in late 2013, I told my founders, like, we need to talk. We went to this coffee shop in Palo Alto that we frequented. And I said, like, it's time to pivot. We got about maybe 6 months of cash, if that, left. And this is just does not appear to be scaling. And I'm just afraid the next turn of the knob is not going to solve that problem. So it was a forced pivot. And we moved really urgently to do it over just a couple months. And again, it saved the company. And I think we're fortunate. Most pivots don't really work, if I had to guess. And most people end up and eventually just giving up. But ours worked pretty quickly. That was the good thing. When we launched a standard loan product, which is what it did, move from this income share notion to really just a standard unsecured amortized loan, our business like overnight started to take off. And not to say we didn't have problems, but at least relative to the prior pain, it felt like nirvana.
Yeah. Did you have a bank partner that was extending credit at that time? Like, who held the credit risk on the loans?
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, in the income share world, we had no bank partner at all. We were doing this stuff ourselves. There was a lot of regulatory ambiguity. Once we were getting into this loan concept, we clearly needed a bank partner. So that was one of the urgent tasks. It was literally, you know, the week before Christmas in 2013. And I'm like smiling and dialing to 20 different small banks who might
praying somebody's not on vacation.
Yeah. And literally finally one did. Cross River Bank decided that it would make sense to work with us. The rest of them kind of said, no, thank you. And so we needed bank partners. The banks, the loans at that time, it was sort of a mix. We funded some ourselves, probably 20%, if I had to remember back in those days. And then mostly hedge funds and all would buy them, and they would take enormous bite out of us for doing that. The first hedge funds that funded our loans, you know, got big chunks of equity in the company. So it went from being what amounts to really expensive capital and not really scalable, but it gets you through the first proof point, if you will, of what you're doing. And then over time, you know, of course, we moved to more efficient capital. But it was a trying. That's why I say it was a trying phase. We we sort of could figure out how many loans we could fund in a month based on the deals we had. And I kind of learned my lesson about New York hedge funds. I'll say that as well, which is, you know, it's a little different world out there, and had some experiences that I was really spun my head around in terms of how that works out there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like they were willing to take the paper, but the terms weren't exactly the nicest.
That's right.
So, wow, that's really interesting. So were you doing your own syndications at that time and calling up the hedge funds to find partners, or did you have a third party that was placing the, like, getting the meetings for you to place it?
We were mostly hustling. These were done as what amounts to what are typically called forward flow agreements. So the bank originates the loan, holds it a few days, and then it sells it on through a deal that we structure to a hedge fund. And the hedge fund might say, hey, I can fund 10, 20 million a month or whatever it is. So you just sort of have this roster of funds that are, you know, and we weren't paving that road. I mean, there were others that had done this. So there was sort of a known set of people you go out to. But yeah, it was constructing these very complicated agreements. We had our very first institutional agreement to buy these loans was with a firm that's notoriously difficult. And the term sheet for this thing, before it even got to an agreement, was like 36 pages. It was like, Dave's children will be handed over if loss rates exceed X, Y, or Z. And we fortunately never ended up signing that agreement. I think we'd still be working to sign it today. We had someone else come in because the market was pretty hot and just gave us a simple two-page version where my kids did not need to be handed over in the event of excess defaults. So, you know, that was just the time where we were learning a lot about stuff we didn't know that much about. And we knew just enough to sort of get through it and survive. And you know, fast forward, we were sponsoring securitizations starting in 2017. We have banks now funding a lot of the loans, which is much more efficient funding. There's still credit funds and such that buy lots of the credit or buy bonds and such. So now it's grown into a very kind of diverse ecosystem of sources of capital that make it all work. But that was the very modest beginning to it.
Yeah, so Cross River Bank, you still have a good sized relationship with, right?
That's right. They were supposed to be our only bank partner for the first 5 years, and then just a few years ago, we started to, you know, say, look, we're going to expand out. We're going to become a provider of technology to banks, and so suddenly that was sort of a business model decision that was made, you know, several years into this thing, and so we started to add additional banks. But Cross River Bank was still our first bank partner, still a very important partner to us. And most of the loans, not all of them, that end up in the capital markets actually go through Cross River and one other bank. So they kind of provide a role that's kind of like a conduit, meaning there's a certain amount of risk that banks are willing to take on their balance sheet. But there's a much broader world out there. So there's a whole bunch of credit that makes sense for us to facilitate that ends up in the capital markets or in the you know, broader market, institutional markets, where there's kind of a much broader appetite for risk, and it all works out best for us.
Yeah. When I started to research, I saw the concentration to Cross River, and I have seen it cited as at least a yellow flag, and I would highly encourage people to look into the risk themselves. But then as I dug deeper, I realized, well, a lot of this paper is getting sold out to the securitized market, and it's not as if.
Well, the way to think of it is, banks always have cheaper funding because they fund loans with deposits. So think of it as, you know, there's 40-ish banks and credit unions on the platform, and anytime someone applies for a loan, the first one of those banks or credit unions, if they make an offer to them, if it fits in their risk profile, et cetera, that's going to be the best offer, and that's what the consumer is going to see. If it doesn't fit them, because they might say, oh, look, we just don't want anything with expected loss rates higher than 3%, 4% a year, whatever their kind of risk appetite is, suddenly there's this overflow where it can be funded at probably a little bit higher rate, and it will be sold forward into capital markets. And that's what somebody like Cross River Bank does on our behalf, is that latter part. They actually do keep a bunch of the loans as well, But is that's why I call it a conduit, and it is interpreted or read when you see us as a sort of customer concentration risk, but it's probably not exactly that. We don't necessarily think of them as a customer. They're pretty much a business partner who plays a very important and specific role for us.
Yeah, as you think about that strategically, not that there would be a reason to have another partner, but it's not I don't perceive them to be the only potential partner to do this for you. Is that a fair characterization? Like, if you needed a second partner, it would be possible to get one. Is that fair?
We actually have a second that doesn't get named because it's not as much in volume, but and we expect to have a third. So it's almost like any business, you don't want a single point of failure, no matter what it is. If you're buying silicon, or, you know, certainly the supply chain woes most physical businesses are experiencing today would highlight that. So like any good business, you don't want a single point of failure. And we do have alternatives to Cross River if for some reason they were unable to originate process loans. But yeah, it's a little different than how I think the world interprets it.
Yeah. So something that I find really interesting about your platform, and I mean, you talked about it on the earnings call, the third quarter earnings call, is I believe you're moving into auto. Is that right? That it's the first tangential market that you're going to move into?
That's right. We started in kind of unsecured personal lending and then decided a couple of years ago now that the next sector that made sense is auto lending. And so we're kind of like starting to rapidly ramp into that now.
I mean, you've got there's a large TAM, for lack of a better term, if you're going after all the credit. You know, it's going to be really interesting to watch. And the thing that really clicked for me over the past couple of days was like, boy, the savings that consumers could have and the benefit that these smaller banks that can hold some of the paper that otherwise would not be able to have a chance to bid on some of this stuff. Like, this could really be a win-win solution. That's, if I'm remotely correct, that's got to be a heck of a thing to create. I'd be very proud if I were you.
Yeah, well, we're on the way. I mean, better risk models in credit, significantly better, not like rounding error better, but way better. There's no losers, honestly. Like, it's better for the consumer. It's better for the lender. And to the only extent there's a loser is that some banks will move more quickly into this area of technology and others won't. And so that's the kind of technology you like, where our business success, in our view, is totally aligned with our mission. Our mission being improving access to credit for consumers. And our business objective, of course, is to kind of grow it across flavors of credit and become really a close partner to as many financial institutions as we can. And the good news is, like, they're not in conflict, right? The more we can cover more flavors of credit, the more we can get banks to adopt the technology. We're effectively delivering a better product to consumers or businesses. We are going to get into business lending as well. So it's a win-win. It's a long, hard journey. But as you say, the TAM is unimaginably large. And we just have to decide. You always have this question about how much you spread, if you spread yourself too thin or stay focused more. And that's kind of a judgment call we're kind of making every day.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. One thing, I come from the value investing school, or I don't know, some value investors may be mad at me for even saying that at this point, because I've transgressed in some people's minds. But, you know, one of the things that's tough about watching and analyzing a growth company is figuring out how much of like SG&A, for example, is growth spend versus maintenance spend. And I don't think that you can... I don't want to put you in a weird spot by asking you the question, but just like when you have something that's working and you have such a big TAM and you want to win, how much of, as an operator, how much are you thinking of like generating profit today versus like, let's just go win and then we'll worry about sort of the profit, you know, the accounting profits down the road?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, part of that is an internal debate and discussion. But part of it is a bit of a market reality as well, meaning, you know, particularly if you're a public company, you're operating in an environment where you have to be thoughtful about what the market is valuing these days and whether how it's weighing growth versus profits and this and that. And also the subcategory that you exist in. So we're in this category where, to be honest, there's just always has been a lot of skepticism. Lending as itself is like this almost necessarily evil thing that the world needs. And so a lot of companies tried to do it better and most of them have failed and sort of run aground eventually when a recession hit or whatever. So there's so much skepticism built in that it doesn't get the sort of, I mean, when I think about a new, you know, Rivian, somebody like that coming out, right? more or less zero revenue and they're going to be a $50, $100 billion company, whatever they are, like, that's one where the market is ready to really lean forward and take chances. We're not in that kind of market. So we're a business that's growing super quickly, triple digit growth rates, and we're profitable. And to some extent, we do wrestle with, you know, maybe we're too profitable. Maybe we should be looking to grow market share, this and that. But, you know, importantly, the thing we can really invest in more than anything is the technical talent, you know, the machine learning engineers, the software engineers, product managers. And that part can only grow so fast before you, irrespective of how much money you are willing to throw at it, it just won't work that well. So, you know, we're doubling or more that sort of growth in that technical talent, which really limits how fast we can go. So, I mean, we're thinking hard about that. Being a profitable business in a heavily competed industry such as lending, I think is a great indicator to the world that there's something special going on here. But there's just inherent skepticism, whether you talk to technology investors, financial services investors, for different reasons, they both end up with a fair degree of skepticism in the category, which is okay. It means it's harder for other people to get funded in it. It just means there is this, what we call belief adoption curve, that is elongated. And that means, you know, those who can get comfortable and understand the questions to ask and where to dig in early have, as investors, enormous potential. And I still believe that's where we are. There is still, despite our success, we've been public for a little over a year now, done incredibly well in terms of delivering the numbers, growth, et cetera. But I just think there's inherent skepticism. Like, it's kind of like this AI thing. Either it's completely impossible or everybody's doing it. I'm not sure which is true, but one of those two things must be true. So I can't really invest in this company. Like, I think that's kind of what we're up against in many ways, that people can't believe we're doing something so distinct and separate that everybody else wouldn't already be doing it. Or maybe it's all just, you know, smoke and mirrors anyway. So that's the foundation of the belief adoption curve. And that's okay, because we have time, we're generating cash, we're growing quickly. If it takes a while for the world to come around and really appreciate what we're doing, you know, we're okay with that.
I think you're actually talking to myself, just like a couple of years ago, maybe. But that has been one of my sort of, one of the things that I think happens when you read investment transcripts and whatnot is the buzzwords come around, right? And like AI and machine learning is one of those buzzwords right now. And I've wondered, like, what's the unique special sauce that can't be replicated? But, you know, without putting words in your mouth, I think as I've realized how much more accurate your models have gotten over time, there's got to be some sort of advantage to the head start, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, yeah, it starts with the team and having people that are capable of building these types of models. And it's really hard to bootstrap that, because if you don't have real deep machine learning model building expertise in your company, that first person you hire, you don't even know whether that person's good or not. How can someone who knows nothing about this hire a great machine learning model developer? So you have this kind of bootstrapping problem, which makes this a hard problem for anybody to solve. Not unsolvable, but we did it, but mostly because my co-founder was that person. So we had that advantage. But it starts with that. Like, you have to have the right team, and then you need critical mass of that team. Once you have a lot of good machine learning engineers developing and doing cool things, it becomes a magnet for talent. It's just much easier to hire the 20th from this first or second or third. And then those teams have to really be working on a mission within a business that works. It has to be funded. The business model has to make sense. You can't just build great AI. A lot of things have to come together. But over time, right, you have this software that you're building that's getting more sophisticated. And as we described earlier, you know, you need a lot of training data. That means your business has to grow and provide that training data. So you do have this kind of like growth trajectory that means the amount of data, the amount of variables, the talent that's working on it, the sophistication of the algorithms that you can implement, they all sort of play off each other. And so you're building what amounts to an enormous moat. Somebody could build maybe a cheaper, cheerful version. And there's no doubt people will say, we're using machine learning for this or that. And, you know, and I don't necessarily say they aren't per se, but Venus Williams and I and both play tennis too. But like,
I like how you said that. Yeah. Yeah. Tiger Woods and I play golf. Differently.
But the subtleties of what it takes to really do it well and do it in a meaningful way that can move a market and make a company, put a company into an elevated position. It's really hard to, it's hard at a first glance to understand. You'd have to honestly really dig in to get there. Ultimately, I always say, though, look, it has to show itself in the company's financials, or who really cares anyway. So that's where you get into this thing where our numbers look really awesome, but why is that? And is it sustainable? And will tomorrow, you know, some enormous bank like Wells Fargo or somebody else replicate what you're doing? And we feel pretty good about our competitive advantage and where it sits in the market.
Well, that's where I used to, that what you're saying used to be what I would say. And I'd be like, well, look at how much JP Morgan's spending on technology, and aren't they going to be able to do the same thing? And I think what I've started to appreciate a little bit better is why does the engineer pick JP Morgan over Upstart or JP Morgan over Google? Or it's a scarce pool of talent that you're all competing for. So there's got to be a reason to go somewhere.
Yeah. And I have no doubt JP Morgan, as well as some other of the largest banks, they have amazing technical talent. So I would never say that they can't build the types of things we're doing. We would hope to win them over to say, look, you can work with us and with much more assurance without the investment. And this is just an area that's better left to a specialist, a technology company like us. Now, that hasn't totally played out. So it's unclear whether a large bank, or I think it's pretty clear a mid-sized bank is not going to do that. But the largest of banks, they may try and take shots in various ways. But I think, it's this the nature of it will play out whether this is something banks feel they can build and own themselves. To us, it seems very obvious that it's just not going to be in the sweet spot for banks to build models like we've built over time. And that's why we're optimistic. We think over time, maybe they'll try, maybe they'll fail. Maybe some will see success. It's such a large disruption and such a large opportunity. It would be kind of shocking if there weren't several choices in the market. And one of those choices might just be a homegrown solution by a very large bank.
Well, one of the nice things that you provide, at least as I perceive it, is the small bank a fighting chance. Because for a while I was like, these small banks are just going to get, they just don't have the scale to invest in the technology to be able to compete. And if they can outsource something like this credit decision, I'm sure they have their own parameters. And like you said, they don't want certain, they've got their own capital restrictions that they don't want to incur or whatever, but to the extent that they want to take the paper, it's nice for them to be able to have good loans to match against the deposits that they're growing, because I was worried for a while that small banks would, just kind of be in a tough spot.
Yeah. I mean, community banks have been, even before the onslaught of fintech, have just been challenged by the largest banks who have much more money to spend to just move their operations, their technology forward. So then you sort of layer in fintech and the sort of changing needs of consumers. And it really is hard to be a community bank or maybe a credit union these days and keep up with the world, if you will. But having said that, small banks are so important to the communities they serve, right? It's one of the real caution points when bank branches close in underserved communities. That's just bad news. It's just as bad as when the grocery stores close. And so keeping their business models working, keeping them up to date on technology is one of the great things. And virtually all the banks on our platform today they're smaller regional or community. But I think by partnering with us, we can make their business models viable. We can keep their branches open, begin to integrate a fully digital kind of experience with an in-branch experience in ways that, they'll be here in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And I think that's obviously great for them, but it's great for the communities they serve. And I just think, consolidation into a handful of giant banks isn't really where the U.S. wants to go, right? We want a more vibrant market than that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the nice thing about community banks is they know the community better, and they're willing to take risks on community businesses that maybe a bigger bank wouldn't. And to the extent that they can have a chance to survive, which I know a lot of community banks have been thriving, but I'm glad that this is another route that they have, because I think that it's an important part of the economy, like you said. Yeah. I think a lot of people like to make are like, banks are great for headlines and punching bags, but banks do a lot of really good stuff in the economy when you get to the nuts and bolts of banking, when you get to the investment banking stuff. You know, maybe we can debate some of that, but
yeah, that's for sure.
It's like plain vanilla commercial banking is extremely important to a vibrant economy.
No question.
One thing that you had said in one of your interviews, I think you said 4 of 5 upstarters have not come into the office at that time. I don't know if it's still true. Is that true that like you hired so many people remote, or am I making something up?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, because of COVID, we've been more or less entirely remote for coming up on 2 years now. And I don't know, again, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but I, you know, we're probably 1600 plus people now. And when COVID started, we were maybe 300 or 400. So wow. That means the vast majority of people at Upstart, first of all, were hired during COVID, which yeah. means, you know, with a few exceptions, they probably never even been to an office at Upstart. So it's, you know, and for a few months, it was kind of like an oddity. Now it's just reality. It's just, you know, most people have never been in one of our offices, and they only know the version of Upstart where they're generally working from home or somewhere else. And so we've, you know, quickly adapted our plans over time and started, it took us a while to recognize like, this isn't temporary. Even when COVID goes away, we're not going back the way we were. And it took me a while. I mean, I've been around the block a while, and, you know, for me, work is get up and get in your car and drive to work. And it was that way for many decades, and just kind of realizing, wow, that is not coming back. I used to laugh when I read some of the first people that said, oh, that's never coming back. I was like, oh, please. And, you know, a few months go by and I'm like, I think he's right. This is not coming back. And so we're still adapting to it this day.
How do you instill a sense of culture remotely when you've hired that many people and over the pandemic? Like, that's got to be difficult to to keep the culture together. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah, what we've done now is probably a little different from what we'll do going forward when theoretically the pandemic is less of a thing. But for now, I mean, we do certain things. For example, every once a month, 3 founders get together on a Zoom call for an hour with all new employees, and we just talk about ourselves and where the company came from, and it's kind of a bare bones introduction to who we are as people, what we built, what happened in the last X years to get us here, and what our mission is. So, and we just do that. And it's like every fourth Friday morning at 9 o'clock, I'm doing this. And it feels a little, I mean, it can get tiresome, honestly, but it's like, but people are floored. They're like, wow, I was at this other company for 8 years and never met the CEO once and never met. So the idea that they're going to spend an hour in a relatively small group, we're hiring a lot of people in a month, so it's not that small. And we do things like that. We have a TGIF every Friday, literally a 45-hour long thing where, you know, updates on the company, open mic Q&A.
Oh, that's cool.
We've been doing, that's an old Google thing that we replicated, and we've been doing since the beginning of the company. And then, you know, during COVID, I was doing a lot of sending out, you know, updates and emails. So you just try to do what you can do digitally, and it's worked well. We do anticipate, as we're sort of hopefully getting beyond COVID, we're not giving up our offices entirely. Our notion generally is we're going to have teams come in about once a month to either our California office or Columbus, Ohio office and spend 2 or 3 days together in what we call on-sites. And those are semi-structured, semi-unstructured. But the idea being is, look, you can live anywhere in the U.S. you want, but once a month. And not for everybody, not necessarily for the individual engineer, but for most people, you know, expect to come to one of these offices, spend a couple of days with your team. And we have this kind of core belief that all those important things that we all love about working together, being in person, building relationships, can actually be done with less volume, meaning only a couple of days a month, but high quality. And that might really end up being the best of both worlds, where you can recruit across the country. There's some disruption, people needing to travel to get together once a month. But this is the model we're kind of aiming toward now. We call it digital first. It's just our name for it. But we'll see. We haven't really proven it yet. But that's where we stand now. That's kind of our plan going forward from here.
That's cool. I like that concept. Why Ohio?
It's funny. Well, you know, we most of our first years, we were only here in the Bay Area. And pretty much I was always in the, like, we love being on one room, one floor of one room. Like, just so much happened because we were a small team, you know, just figuring things out quickly. So I was as resistant as anybody to having multiple offices. And it became clear a few years back that we just would never be able to hire enough people that we wanted to. We were always behind on hiring and just decided, look, we can't hire all the technical talent in the Bay Area, particularly with the competition from the big tech companies here who were just raising the salaries of their offers, this and that. It was just getting crazy. So we looked around and our qualifications were fairly simple, which is, you know, a lot of talent, number one, technical talent predominantly. Number two, no competition, at least hopefully for a while, from big tech. So we didn't want to drop into, let's just say, Seattle Austin, where there's just big tech companies are already very aggressively scaling there. And Columbus, Ohio, and we happen to have one of our very first employees, Grant Schneider, who's our first kind of and leads our machine learning team. He's a 3-degreed Ohio State guy. And so that was sort of the closer. And, you know, Columbus is a big city, almost 1 million people. It's the second largest city in the Midwest after Chicago, which is kind of stunning. Yeah, and it's growing and it's high quality of life. Now, I'm a University of Michigan graduate. So let me tell you, this did not come easily to me. When I first told friends, they were convinced it was a practical joke that we were opening an office in Columbus, Ohio. But in any case, we didn't know. It's funny, when we first announced the company, we leased some office space and thought, man, this office space could just be empty. Maybe we're just not going to find the people. It's not going to work. And by the time that office space opened, we had already overfilled it. So within a couple of years, it was the biggest part of our company. Now, since that's almost in a strange way been obsoleted, meaning we're now hiring everywhere, but we still consider, you know, Columbus, Ohio, and here, San Mateo, California, as our kind of co-headquarters. And people will spend time there. There'll be a lot here. But I think in the last quarter, I think the numbers are like 2/3, or is it 3/4 of the people are hired outside of our kind of Ohio, California footprint. So. It's really, you know, COVID changed everything.
Do you get a lot of applications for University of Illinois or from University of Illinois? I only ask because I'm an ex-Chicago guy and Illinois, like people used to tell me it has a great computer program. I just wonder from the Midwest whether or not you get some good Big Ten talent.
Yeah, for sure. University of Illinois is definitely renowned for computer science. I think it's where Mark Andreessen went, right? The founder of Netscape. So it's definitely a famous school. And there's great talent throughout the Midwest and the Big Ten for sure. We've historically like hired people with some years of experience technically. I think now we're starting to like when you really want to grow fast and you need talent, you can't always go find the people that already have the skill. So I think we're going to start moving closer to doing just university grad programs, like hiring people right out of university, which we haven't done that much of. But honestly, like when your gating item to your growth and your success is technical talent, you have to really constantly rethink your model because it's a battle out there. I mean, especially, you know, this whole crypto explosion, suddenly there's a huge sort of magnet for talent into crypto. And, you know, we aren't today, you know, really a crypto company, maybe someday, but not today. So that's just another sort of wave we have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, if I were in your shoes, I'd say we've got a big opportunity here. Let's win this opportunity. We'll worry about crypto down the road. So I can understand why that would be a secondary priority.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
It's got to be tough to compete with talent, for talent. Along those lines, do you mind just kind of telling me a little bit about your philosophy of share-based compensation? This is something that comes up a lot in the value investing school where, you know, a lot of us look at free cash flow and they say, well, and I've done it myself, right? It's like, well, it's all share-based compensation. Where I have sort of got to in that is I kind of like financing with some employee skin in the game as well and giving everybody upside, but it's something that took me a long time to get my head around. So I'd be interested to hear you talk about it.
Yeah. So we have from the beginning, I guess in true Silicon Valley style, always had equity ownership of some form or another part of employment. Every employee has some equity ownership in the company. So that's pretty fundamental. We don't just accept that. I mean, we have definitely had some discussions and looked at the fact that particularly when you're early in the equity, it's really unclear if it's going to be worth anything. Party says, well, let's just give them cash if they want cash. And, you know, companies like Netflix are kind of famous for that. I think Netflix, I don't know if it's true today, but for most of their history, they really just said, we're just going to give people great salaries and we're not going to bother with equity. They just took a sort of distinctly different path than most of, you know, the technology world. We didn't go there, though. We've debated it and such. So I would say, first of all, I think one of the issues there is it just has the risk of selecting for the wrong people. Because you kind of need people that have an optimism and a belief and an appetite for risk, meaning this equity might be worth nothing, but it could be worth a lot someday. And I that's one of the more fundamental reasons we did not go to pure cash as a way to compensate people. Is we just fear it will select for the wrong people and we'll end up with a company of risk averse people, which yeah. in our world is not really going to work.
That makes sense. It would also then make sense if you were to say, well, the senior people that have taken the most risk get the most future equity, and those that, like, now the equity is de-risked, right? Your company is at escape velocity, at least certainly appears to be to me. So that's interesting. That's an interesting way to think about it.
Well, certainly once you're public, the equity is a little more cash-like, meaning, you know, there might be a cliff or a vest period and there's only trading windows and that. So it's not as pure as cash. But you know, I think done right, it's the right system. It shares in the upside of the company. I mean, one of the best things about going public and then the success we had since we went public is really just how many people who's inside the company whose lives have changed. I mean, of course, the stock's been up and down and all around, and that's part of the journey that you can't go without. But it is to see a meaningful success and really change the lives of people who might not even have expected it. Like, that is one of the most gratifying things of the journey so far.
Yeah, that's cool. Speaking of the stock volatility, how do you keep people focused when the stock is flying up? And then, I mean, you know, and when I say your stock, it's not just your stock. I mean, the whole space had sort of, I don't want to call it a blow off top, but that's what's in my head. Certainly some speculative valuations. And now they've come closer down to earth. How do you keep people focused on the job at hand rather than looking at the stock price during the day?
Yeah, it's always a bit of a challenge. I mean, I think it's just a constant reinforcement of some basic ideas. Relative to some companies, we had some advantages, meaning when we went public for $20 a share, less than a $2 billion valuation. And then we had an enormous run up from there, but we at least have that base that, you know, we started at a modest place. Whereas a lot of companies really went public at crazy valuations and then they've just suffered from there. So a little bit of a less severe problem than others might have in that way. I think in general, of course, the story is that I will always say is like, we don't control the stock. We can only control the business and build the business. And as usual, it might sound like a platitude, but you know, the market will recognize the business over time for what it is. So we have neither power, and hopefully we're not getting too distracted by the stock. We're just saying like, look, eyes on the horizon. We have this place we want to be in 3 years or 5 years. And assuming we can get there, there's no doubt the market's going to appreciate that and it's going to work out. So I think that's the only way to say it is like, I mean, the reality is, I'm sitting here seeing our stock go up and down as much as any random investor in our stock is. And like, it's in so many degrees of it outside our control. Now, over the long period, of course, it's not outside our control. And that's what's important is as long as we're doing the right things and we feel like we're on that trajectory and we're fixing the problems, we're addressing whatever issues we find, you know, stock's going to do what it's going to do. But I can confidently say like, look, there's this place we want to get to. I think we can see it. It's not perfectly clear, but we can see it and we know it's a matter of execution to get there. And you should all feel pretty damn good about what the company's likely worth at that time frame if we're able to achieve these things.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Focus on the long term and execution. I just think it's hard enough as somebody that you know, looks at markets a lot. It's hard enough to train myself not to look. So I can only imagine if I worked, I mean, I worked at Bank of Montreal, our stock was not very volatile. But even then, I mean, people knew, and it was just kind of hard to prevent the conversation in the office. So I would imagine with a stock as volatile as yours was last year, it would be a topic of conversation among some.
I'm sure it is. We're not in the office, of course, so it's a little different. But
on Slack or whatever.
Yeah, you can't really tell people not to watch the stock. I think it's just under a certain context. Of course, there's some entertainment value to the whole thing. You get a little numb to it, whether it's going up or down. But you know, I don't tell people ignore the stock. I think that's sort of unfair. It's, of course, so meaningful to their compensation and all they've done. But I just try to provide the context. If you want to spend a lot of time looking at the stock, I'm not going to say one way or the other whether that's right. But I would just say, look, of course, you have to think about this over a long period of time, because that's clearly what we're trying to do is not about next week or next month.
Yeah. How do you think about, you know, whether or not you're going to increase the amount of the loans you hold, or whether or not you want to sell all the loans? I mean, is there a philosophical ethos? I like how you avoid a lot of the credit risk, but, you know, sharing in some of the credit risk, also you arguably have aligned incentives, right? So just kind of curious as you grow, how you think through that.
Yeah, well, I guess our position is really we're a technology provider to lenders, but we're not a lender ourselves as a business. So, you know, just like many others who would provide technology to do various activities to a bank or to any type of company, like that's our position is we're building better models, but we provide the tool set to banks and other lenders to use it in a way that makes sense for their business. But we're not, it just hasn't been. Now, having said that, because banks are regulated, because they're conservative, as they should be, we do fund a certain small fraction, a few percentage of our loans, to test and experiment in new areas. So when I say we're not a lender, we're never a lender, but we do buy back some of the loans when we're trying to experiment and sort of push the boundaries. And as a technology company, that's really powerful. I view that as effectively, it's a part of our balance sheet that's going into R&D. But because if we had to say, like, okay, every time we're going to upgrade a certain thing or launch a new product, you know, we suddenly need a whole bunch of banks to appreciate that and want to buy into that on day one, that would be really difficult for us as a business to move quickly. So one of the things I would say puzzles you're always trying to solve from our seat is, how do you stay innovative, moving quickly in a very regulated and very conservative industry? And we do that by taking some credit risk at the margins to experiment and do things where if it doesn't go well, it's only our money that's at risk. And that's worked well for us. But generally speaking, a lot of fintechs have moved into a place where they're becoming banks. They are holding the credit. And in my mind, that's actually a completely different business with its own set of rules and guidelines and limitations and advantages. But it's a completely different business, and that's not one we're particularly interested in.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I was trying to figure out, I knew that you held some small portion of credit risk, but doing it to test new products, it makes perfect sense to me. And it's not really fair to tell your bank partners, hey, you guys take this credit risk while we test out a new product, right? So it's nice to see you eating your own cooking on that. For people that don't know, you get a referral fee, platform fees, and then servicing fees. That's how you generate revenue, right?
Yeah, that's right. Those are all fees generally paid to us by banks or whomever ends up holding the loans if they're sold forward from the banks. But yeah, it's a fee-based business. It's transactional and volume-based. So in many ways, I mean, it's reflective of, I don't know, Twilio, companies like that who really are volume-based, fee-based businesses. And it's works really well for us.
Yeah. Have any of the changes in Facebook's targeting, has that impacted your marketing spend at all? Or is that not typically the type of channel that you're using? I'm just curious whether or not it's impacted your business. I'm not asking you to disclose
not really.
Anything material.
Facebook, for sort of related but different reasons, kind of made it harder to target for anything related to a financial product. Years ago, Facebook advertising is not an enormous part of our mix. It is part of it. We do some advertising on Facebook and Instagram, but I would just say it's a very modest part. It's always been. It's just for a variety of reasons, not nearly as productive as other channels. So, no, frankly, it's the recent changes with Apple and those haven't been material to us.
Yeah. It was interesting to watch. I just figured I'd ask. So, you know, I know you're a busy guy and I appreciate the time that you've given. Is there a, you know, I hate this question, but is there something that I should have asked you that you want to say? I want to make sure that you have the ability to tell people what you want to tell them. I did think, actually, a very interesting factoid is that your median borrower is like 28 or 29.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't an intention on our part. It just happened to be the first kind of enormous demographic that was underserved by the legacy system, if you will. The incumbent system was young people who couldn't get loans, couldn't get access to credit for, you know, all the reasons we said. They don't have a lot of credit history. So yeah, and that has just carried forward to this day. It still tends to be a younger demographic. It's a fully digital product. They appreciate the convenience and all that. And also, of course, most 28-year-old, dare I say, have probably very rarely, if ever, been to a bank branch. So it's sort of well-suited for them.
Yeah. Well, there are worse demographics to have traction with.
That's right.
So congrats on the success. And I'm just going to kick it back to you. Is there anything else that you think that we should cover? Or do you think we covered some base as well?
No, this is great. It's been a fun conversation. I really appreciate it. Absolutely necessary.